A man had been found dead in a room at the Stag Inn at Wormsley Vale. He had registered as Enoch Arden, but had hinted that he might be Robert Underhay, the first husband of Rosaline Claude. Underhay had been reported dead in Africa, and she had married again, married Gordon Claude, a multimillionaire much older than herself. But Claude had been killed in an air raid, and his vast fortune had passed to her. All Claude's relatives, who felt that Rosaline had deprived them of their rightful inheritance, wanted the dead man to be Underhay, for then her marriage would be invalid. Major Porter had identified the body as that of Underhay, but he had lied, and had subsequently shot himself. So, which of the Claudes had induced him to bear false witness? Who was the mysterious woman seen coming out of Enoch Arden's room on the night of his death? And who was his murderer?
John Moffat as Hercule Poirot in Agatha Christie's Taken at the Flood.
I didn't realize you were still in Wormsley Vale, Monsieur Poirot. I can't imagine what you find so attractive about the place.
Oh, it is pleasantly out of the world. Here I can relax and smell the country air and exercise the little grey cells.
So, what are you doing now?
Oh, I talk to people, mademoiselle. Pick up little pieces of gossip here and there.
What kind of gossip? I suppose you've heard things about me and Rowley and David.
But you are still going to marry Rowley Claude?
Am I? That's what I was wondering the night the man, whoever he was killed. I stood watching that train puffing up the valley. And then David burst suddenly out of the wood and threw everything into confusion.
Confusion about your marriage?
Oh, it's all so difficult. It isn't really a question of David at all. It's me. I've changed. I'm not the same person who went away.
But why did you go away in the first place?
I went to join the Wrens.
But why? You were engaged to be married. You were in love with Rowley Claude. You could have stayed on here as a land girl, could you not?
I could have, I suppose. But I wanted...
You wanted to get away. Perhaps you wanted to get away from Rowley Claude.
But when I was out east, I missed him terribly. I longed for home.
Yes. Where you are not, there you will want to be. What are your feelings about him now?
I wish I knew. I've grown too used to Rowley. And there's such a terrible anger in him now. He always had a short temper. But there are times when he looks at me like a mad bull.
Is that altogether surprising?
What do you mean?
I think you know very well.
You mean because of David? You think I'm in love with him?
Well, that is for you to say.
There's something in David that I'm afraid of. But there's something that draws me too. And I don't know whether I can really trust him. Can you love someone you can't trust?
Unfortunately, yes.
And there's been so much stupid gossip about him. People saying that he wasn't Rosaline's brother at all, but just an old boyfriend she palmed off on Uncle Gordon.
It is curious how people can get hold of the wrong end of a stick.
What do you mean?
Just what I say. Tell me, did Mrs. Lionel Claude ring you here on the night of the murder?
Yes, she did.
May I ask what about?
Oh, some stewed muddle over the coffee morning.
And did she speak from her own phone?
No, apparently it was out of order. She had to go out to a telephone box. She didn't have the right change, but fortunately there was a woman who was just finishing a call who was able to help her.
What kind of woman?
She was wearing an orange scarf. Aunt Kathy said she looked vaguely familiar, but then you know what she is. She said it must have been someone who passed over.
And at what time was this?
About 10:10. Our clocks don't keep particularly good time.
But that was not the only telephone call you had that evening.
No.
David Hunter rang you from London?
Yes. I suppose you want to know what he said.
Oh, mademoiselle.
Well, you're quite welcome to know. He said he was going away and clearing out of my life. That he was no good to me and that he would never run straight, not even for my sake.
Mm-hmm. And since that was probably true, you didn't like it.
I hope he will go away. I hope they'll both go away to America or somewhere. Then perhaps we shall all learn to stand on our own feet again and stop feeling ill will and wishing Rosalind dead.
Her death is, of course, the only thing that can do you any practical good.
The poor girl looks like a ghost already, scared to death, living by herself in that great empty house, and she won't let any of us help.
Have you tried? You yourself?
I went up there yesterday, asked her if there was anything I could do. She just looked at me and said, "You least of all."
Huh? Why should she say that, mademoiselle?
I've no idea. Is it something to do with Roly, do you think? She's been to see him at Long Willow's, and I think he's the only one of us she likes. Could she be in love with him?
I have the greatest pity for her. If she would listen, I would try to help her. Come, let us make the attempt. Let us go to Furrowbank.
You want me to come with you?
If you are prepared to be understanding and generous.
Of course. Why don't we go straight away?
I'm afraid Madame isn't down yet. If you'd care to wait in the drawing room, I'll go and find out whether she wishes to see you.
A curiously impersonal room.
The whole house is like that. Uncle Gordon lavished money on the place, but he had no real taste of his own.
The wages of sin are said to be death, but sometimes the wages of sin seem to be luxury. Is that any more endurable, I wonder? To be cut off from one's own life, to catch perhaps a single glimpse of it when the way back to it is barred?
She won't come down. I know she won't. She doesn't want to have anything to do with...
Miss Marshman! Something's happened to Mrs. Claude! She doesn't speak, and I can't wake her, and her hands are cold as ice! Come quickly!
She has been dead for quite some time. She must have died in her sleep.
Oh, sir, what are we going to do?
You must go and telephone her doctor at once, and you had better ring the police also.
The police? Yes, sir.
What is that box on her bedside table?
Powders of some kind. One to be taken at bedtime.
How many are left?
Three. And there's a paper here. She's written something.
Read it, but do not touch it.
I don't know what to do. I can't go on. I must tell someone and find peace. I didn't mean to be wicked. I didn't realize what was going to come of it.
Rosalind!
David, have they released you?
Rosalind. So, you got rid of her at last. You sent me to jail on a trumped-up charge, and then, amongst you all, you put her away.
David, no!
If only they'd let me go 24 hours earlier. You weren't able to touch her when I was around, but as soon as she was alone, you saw your chance and took it. Well, you wanted her damned money, and now you've got it.
No, David, none of us would touch her. You know that very well.
I think perhaps that your assumptions are a little overdramatic, Mr. Hunter. Why jump to the conclusion that your sister was murdered?
So what do you call this? A natural death?
There is a note on her bedside table. Mm. No, no, do not pick it up.
You mean she killed herself? But why would she do that?
Supposing that last Tuesday night your sister wasn't in London, but in Wormsley Vale. Suppose she went to see the man who'd been blackmailing her. Suppose that in a nervous frenzy, she killed him.
My sister was in London on Tuesday night. You know that very well.
Yes, Mr. Hunter. That is your version of events, and I dare say you'll stick to it. But whether it's true enough is hardly relevant now. The case will never come to court.
It is permitted, Superintendent, to ask you two questions.
Anything you like.
Those sleeping powders of Rosalind Close, what were they?
Some kind of harmless bromide.
So what kind of poison killed her?
We haven't had the full results yet, but it looks like morphine, and a pretty hefty dose of it.
Was any morphine found in her possession?
No, none. What are you getting at?
I will pass on to my second question. David Hunter put through a call to Lynn Marchmont at 11:05 on the night of the murder. You checked up on all calls from the flat that night. Were there any incoming calls?
Yes. There was one at 10:15 from a public call box in Wormsley Vale.
And was that call answered?
I see what you mean. Yes, it was answered. So there must have been someone in the flat. It couldn't have been Hunter, since he was still on the train on his way to London. So it can only have been Rosalind Claude. In which case, she wasn't the girl in the orange scarf, and she didn't kill Arden. But if she didn't, who did? Rosalind Claude and her brother were the only ones with even a shadow of a motive.
Ah, the motive. It is that which has been leading us astray. If A had a motive for killing C, and B has a motive for killing D, it does not seem to make sense that A should kill D and B should kill C.
Go easy. I have the faintest idea what you're talking about.
It is complicated because we have two different kinds of crime, and consequently two different murders. Enter first murderer and enter second murderer.
Spare me the Shakespeare, for heaven's sake.
But this is a very Shakespearean mystery. Jealousy, hatred, opportunism. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune.
Look, Monsieur Poirot, why can't you say what you mean?
I will be very clear. We have here, have we not, three deaths. But how did these people die?
Well, you know the answer to that. One murder and two suicides. Though the second suicide is beginning to look like a second murder.
According to my way of thinking, there has been one accident, one suicide, and one murder in that order.
Accident? But the man's head was beaten in with a poker.
When I say there was an accident, I mean that there was no intent to kill.
You mean he was attacked by a lunatic?
I think that is very near the truth, though not quite in the sense that you mean it.
And did this same lunatic kill Rosalind Claude as well?
Oh, by no means, no. This is where first murderer makes his exit and second murderer enters. Quite a different kind of crime. Cold and deliberate and passionless. And I intend to see that her murderer hangs for it.
You've got to give me more than this to go on, Monsieur Poirot.
Just as soon as I receive responses to the telegrams I sent off yesterday.
What kind of responses?
I have asked the next of kin of the three servants who were killed in the Blitz with Gordon Claude to send me the victims' photographs. That will give me all the evidence I need to bring the murderer to justice.
It's no good, Lynn. I can't pretend anymore. That night I phoned you from London. I meant to get out of your life, but it's no good. I was a fool to think I could leave you behind me. You know as well as I do, we were made for one another.
Yes, David, I do know. I've tried to fight against it, but it's simply no use.
I'm not going to give you the chance to fight against it anymore. We'll go to London and get married by special license. Don't trouble about Rowley. We'll break it to him when you're actually Mrs. David Hunter.
You're going to marry David Hunter? Why?
Because I love him.
Oh, no, Lynn. You love me.
That's not true any longer, really. I did love you, but then I went away. It's been 4 years and I've changed. We've both changed.
You're wrong. I haven't changed, Lynn. I haven't been in the war. I missed my chance of fighting for my country because I had to stay here and run the farm. I've seen my girl dress in uniform and go off overseas. I've been the man she left behind her. My life's been hell. Don't you understand? Then you came back, and I had to sit and watch you and Hunter making eyes at each other across Aunt Kathy's table and meeting out in the garden. And now you say you're going off with him.
Yes.
Well, he's not going to have you. If you're not for me, then nobody shall have you.
Really?
I've killed two people. Do you think I'd stick at killing a third? He's not going to have you, Lynn.
I hope that I do not intrude. I knocked, but no one answered. Perhaps, Mr. Claude, you could go and boil us a kettle and make us some coffee.
Look here. I don't think you understand. I was trying to strangle Lynn.
Two lumps, if you please.
I've got two deaths on my conscience already. Hers would have been the third if you hadn't arrived.
Let us drink our coffee.
How much do you know? Do you realize I killed Charles Trenton?
Perhaps we should continue to call him Enoch Arden. Yes, I have known that for some time.
Lynn, your mother told me he'd come here. What the devil's the matter with your throat?
Another cup for Mr. Hunter, if you please, Mr. Claude.
Yes, of course.
Sit down, Mr. Hunter. We shall drink our coffee, and you shall all three listen to Hercule Poirot while he gives you a lecture on crime.
Here's your coffee.
Thanks.
I can't believe this is really happening.
From the very beginning, I asked myself this question. What happens? What happens when people who have been protected from real life suddenly find that protection taken away from them virtually overnight? Most of us learn to stand on our own 2 feet early in life, but this did not happen with the Clodes. When their protector and benefactor was taken from them, for the very first time they were forced to look life in the face.
And we didn't much care for what we saw.
All that stood between them and the safe and happy existence they had taken for granted was the life of one person, Rosalind Claude. The thought of her death passed through all their minds, of that I am certain, and the possibility of murder also. Did you think of killing her, Mr. Claude?
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact. She came past the farm one day, out for a walk, she said. There was no one else about. She looked pretty and rather pathetic, like the calves I'd sent off to market that morning. I thought how easy it would be to kill her. It was in my mind when I took the lighter from her to light her cigarette.
Ah, so that is how you got hold of it.
Yes, I forgot to give it back to her.
And yet you did not yield to the temptation of killing her in cold blood. It was not your sort of crime. The man you did kill, you killed in a fit of rage, and perhaps you did not really mean to kill him.
No, I didn't. I punched him on the jaw. He went over backwards and he hit his head on the marble fender. I just couldn't believe he was dead. But how did you know?
I think I have reconstructed your movements fairly accurately. Beatrice Lippincott told you of the conversation she had overheard at the Stag, and you went straight to your uncle Jeremy Claude to get his opinion. But while you were waiting for him in his study, something caught your attention. A photograph, perhaps.
A photograph of Francis's father. And there were other pictures of her family in the room, all with the same characteristic features. The features of Enoch Arden. I realized that Francis must have got one of her relations to pretend to be Rosalind's first husband and to try to get money out of her.
God, what a despicable bunch you all are.
I went straight to the Stag and up to Arden's room. I told him he was a fraud. He just laughed at me and said that David Hunter would be coming across with the money later that evening. He wasn't just double-crossing Hunter. He was making a mug out of me as well. Well, I saw red and hit out at him.
And it was then, perhaps, that you realized you still had the cigarette lighter.
Yes, I knew it had Hunter's initials on it. It seemed too good an opportunity to resist.
Did it really?
I dragged the body into the middle of the room and picked up the steel tongs.
Oh.
I won't go into details. I wiped off my fingerprints and cleaned up the marble curb. I put Arden's wristwatch forward to 9:10 and smashed it. I wanted to give myself an alibi. And I took away the man's ration book and his papers. I didn't want anyone to trace his identity.
And then you came and asked me to find someone who had known Underhay. Oh, such a pretty little comedy. And I fell for it. I was the complete mug. You already knew what Major Porter had told me that night during the air raid, because the whole conversation had been overheard by your Uncle Jeremy, and he had told you all about it.
Yes, that's true.
But although it took me some time to realize it, Major Porter gave you both away. He offers me a cigarette and says to you, "You don't, I know. Imbecile that I am. I should have realized the truth then." You had already been to see Porter and made your little arrangement together. He would be given a share of the money as soon as Gordon Claude's marriage to Rosaline had been declared invalid. Unfortunately for you, Major Porter had a troubled conscience.
I should have realized he would try to back out of it afterwards. I went up to his flat to try and drive some sense into him, but I was too late. The front door wasn't locked. He was slumped down in the chair with his pistol still in his hand. It was as though I was a murderer twice over.
And was there a note? A note which you took away?
It was to the coroner. He said he'd given perjured evidence and that the dead man was not Robert Underhay.
You got rid of it, you bastard.
I was in too far to go back. I wanted the money so I could get Lynn away from you. And I wanted you to hang for the murder.
Too bad it all went wrong, wasn't it?
But what was all this mysterious woman business? How could she be in there talking to Arden when he was dead?
There was no woman.
But old Mrs. Ledbetter, you talked to her at the Stag. She saw her, she heard her.
And what did she see? She saw someone in trousers and a tweed coat whose heavily made-up face was encircled in an orange scarf. And what did she hear? A man's voice crying, "Get out of here!" Eh bien, it was a man she heard and a man she saw. A very ingenious notion. Was it not, Mr. Hunter?
What do you mean by that, Monsieur Poirot?
It is now to you I will tell a story. You came along to the Stag at about 9 o'clock with the money to pay off Arden, and what do you find? The body of the blackmailer lying on the floor with his head battered in. You realize at once you are in danger. But no one has seen you coming into the Stag, and you set off as fast as you can across country to catch the 9:20 back to London. But then you run unexpectedly into Lynn Marchmont, and you realize it is too late to catch your train.
I should have known. I saw the smoke of the train in the valley, but I failed to connect it somehow.
And when Mr. Hunter tells you it is 9:15, you simply accept it as a fact.
But what about the telephone call?
Ah, that involved an entirely new scheme, did it not, Mr. Hunter? You return to Farrow Bank and help yourself to a scarf of your sister's and her makeup. You go back to the Stag and go through your performance in front of the old lady.
Is this true, David?
I've always prided myself on my act as a female impersonator. And I left the lipstick.
But you rang me from London.
It was really very simple. You ring your sister at the flat from a public call box and tell her that at 11:04 exactly she must put through a call to Lynn Marchmont pretending to be the operator and tell her that there is to be a call from London and she must first replace the receiver. And then, a moment later, you ring the Marchmont home, giving the impression that you are in London.
So that is why you rang me.
You're damn clever, Monsieur Poirot. You pieced it together exactly. But of course, I hadn't the faintest idea who could have killed Arden. As far as I could see, nobody had a motive except myself and Rosaline.
Motive. That has always been the difficulty. Every member of the Claude family had a motive for killing your sister, but it was not one of them that exchanged a sleeping powder for a deadly dose of morphine.
But I don't understand. Who?
This case has always been the wrong way round. She was killed by the person who had most to lose by her death. You killed her, Mr. Hunter.
But why should I kill my own sister?
You killed her because she was not your sister. Rosaline Claude died in the air raid that killed her husband, Gordon Claude. The woman you passed off as her and whom you callously murdered was a young Irish housemaid who survived the blast.
You're bluffing. I'm not going to listen to any more of this. Lynn, come with me now.
Her name was Eileen Corrigan. I received this photograph from her next of kin today.
But that's Rosaline.
Lynn, come now.
I can't.
Then I must take my chance.
I'll get him. He can't go far.
It's not true. It can't be true.
I am afraid that it is all too true, mademoiselle.
But how could he do it?
Imagine for yourself his feelings on the night of the Blitz. His sister dead and Gordon Claude dying. All that wealth and life of ease snatched away from him. And then he looks at the girl lying unconscious, the only survivor apart from himself, a girl roughly the same age as Rosaline and whom he has probably already made his mistress. He has a way with women.
Yes, he has a way with women.
He snatches his chance of fortune. The only people who knew Rosaline Claude are dead, and her husband has not yet introduced her to his family. When Eileen Corrigan regains consciousness, he does not have much difficulty in cajoling her into taking on the role of his sister.
So that was why he hurried her off to London the moment Arden turned up in Walmsley Vale.
He could not risk him getting a sight of her in case he was under hay.
But why did he have to kill her?
Oh, the poor girl was beginning to give way under the strain of it all. Sooner or later she was bound to give the whole thing away. And there was another factor. You had come into his life.
And so he changed one of her sleeping powders for morphine.
He reckoned that no one would suspect him, for he had no motive. The death of Rosaline would mean that the money would pass back to the Claudes. That was his trump card. Everything about this case was always the wrong way round.
They've got him.
You'd already tipped off the police, I take it?
Yes, I had warned them.
Did he say anything?
He said he'd had a good run for his money. He was a gambler and he knew when he'd had his last throw.
There is a tide in the affairs of men, but the tide also ebbs, and it may carry you out to sea.
So what happens now? To Rowley, I mean.
The police will no longer be looking for the killer of Enoch Arden, and I shall not enlighten them.
But what about Major Porter? I'm morally responsible for his death.
Oh, no, you're not. He could have turned down your proposition. He was just a weak character.
You see, already Mademoiselle is taking your side.
But I tried to strangle her.
I do not think you will do it again. You are blinded by jealousy. You could think of nothing but keeping the woman you loved.
I've been the most stupid, blundering fool, risking everything for a man I thought was dangerous and attractive. And he turned out to be a vicious murderer.
And what am I?
Oh, don't be pig-headed and melodramatic. If you have a row with a hulking big man and hit him and he falls down and he hits his head on a fender, that isn't murder.
It's manslaughter. I could go to prison for that.
Well, if you do, I should be waiting outside when they release you.
Bravo, mademoiselle. And now it is time for me to take my leave.
You are finally going back to London.
I have breathed deeply of the air of Wormsley Vale. I have been enchanted by the sweet smells of the countryside. But now I long to be back in town. I miss the gaiety of the shops and the restaurants and the bright lights of which we were so sadly deprived during the dark days of the war. And, rather to my surprise, I miss the smell of cigars and cognac and leather, the particular aroma of my club, where I first heard the tale of Robert Underhay. Who knows what I may hear there when I return?
In the final part of Agatha Christie's Taken at the Flood, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat. Superintendent Spence, Robert Lang. Lynn Marchmont, Susanna Corbett. Rowley Claude, Ivan Meredith. David Hunter, Tom George. The maid, Debbie Hunt. Taken at the Flood was dramatized for radio by Michael Bakewell and directed by Enid Williams.